Quiero.
Welcome, folks. Y'all come on in and make yourself at home. This here? Well, this is the Rolling Thunder Podcast, your home for all things Rolling Thunder. This episode of the Rolling Thunder Podcast is presented by Mossy Oak Camouflage, because everything is better in Bottomland. And Lucky Duck Premium Decoys, masters of deception.
Just want to welcome everybody to another episode of the Rolling Thunder Podcast. We got a telephone call going here that we're recording, so you have to forgive the audio quality. I hope that's not why you're listening, is for high-end technology and audio quality, because if it is, you're at the wrong place. I've got a good friend and an industry, just a great human in the world of hunting, and Mr. David Holly is on the other end of the line. How are you, David?
Man, I'm good, Spencer. How are you?
I'm really good. Tell, where are you at in the world today?
Well, I'm not going to share too many details, you know. No, I'm just kidding. No, I live in West Alabama, a little town called Livingston. It's, you know, it's not too far from the Mississippi state line and kind of situated south of Tuscaloosa. So anyways, that's home. That's where our, family farm is, and where, you know, I grew up on this farm, and so that's where I'm at today.
Are you an Alabama fan, or do you have an SEC team that you root for?
I'm an Alabama grad, and I married an Auburn grad, so we have a mixed marriage. So anyway, it's a very unique dynamic. And anyways, I was at Alabama during some pretty lean years from a football perspective, and graduated right before Nick Saban got there. So anyways, but I guess it has made my fandom even more of a fevered pitch. I've certainly calmed down a little bit with maturation, you know, and you know, enough stares from my wife when I'm jumping up and down during a game yelling at the TV. I'm still very passionate about college football in general, and, you know, I guess you could just say I'm just kind of an all-around passionate person.
Okay, that's good. That's good. Are they going to play this fall?
Gosh, I hope so, because, you know, there's not a whole lot that I do in the fall. You know, I'm not a huge waterfowl guy like you are, just by default where I live. I love it, you know, but I need something to do in the fall. You know, the spring's pretty much booked up for me, but, you know, the fall is, I need college football. And I think a lot of us need college football. And really, a lot of us need a return to normalcy is really what we need.
Yeah, no doubt. I told somebody the other day, I'm ready to go back to church and get a hug from, there's about 25 old ladies that I need to get a Sunday morning hug from.
I know. I told a buddy of mine the other day how much I've missed our, you know, small group. And I said, you know, I don't want to sound weird or anything, but, man, I've missed you guys, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, so kind of give me, how old are you? Are you married? Give me kind of your nutshell of a bio right quick.
Yeah. So I'm 34, and my wife and I have been married, I guess, going on 5 years now. We have a 10-month-old and a little boy, and I don't know if you or anybody else has a chance to catch the on Mossy Oak Go, The Obsessed. They premiered it the other night as a part of the Mossy Oak Go Live series, but really that whole thing kind of centered around, you know, my son Bud and kind of my thoughts for the future. But anyways, we have the, you know, one little boy, and, you know, hopefully we'll, you know, at some point, Lord willing, you know, have another one. And anyways, but I work for Mossy Oak, and they're Mossy Oak Properties Division. I'm the VP of new business, and you know, I've been here for 12 years. Dad helped, you know, start the company with Toxie. So, you know, Mossy Oaks, I mean, it's family and me. And, you know, I've told you several occasions, I know that your blood, you know, bleeds bottom land like mine does. And, that's the cool thing about what we have at Mossy Oak is, I mean, it's, you know, it's not just, the core group's company or, you know, even the folks that work, you know, in the office in West Point. I mean, anyone that, you know, they bleed bottom land, I mean, they're part of the family, and, you know, the feelings are certainly like that to you, you know, Spencer, and all your team.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So I actually, I did not realize that was your day job. So you work in the properties division helping, what does new business mean? Are you setting up new offices, new brokerages?
Yeah. Well, we're a small company, so we wear a lot of different hats. But yeah, setting up new brokerages, any sort of, you know, I'll do a lot with marketing and branding and new services and things like that. So, I mean, we kind of do, you know, what's necessary, take out the trash, a little bit of everything. But my primary role, you know, through the years has been, you know, setting up new franchises and, you know, getting them going and things like that.
I got you. Okay. All right. That's good. So, you know, your episode the other night, obviously, if anybody watched it, they're going to know this about. Well, I tell you what, before I ask you this question, tell me the story real quick. Where did you get your son's name from? There's got to be a story behind Bud.
Yeah, so my grandfather has gone by the name Bud ever since he was three. And if you've ever met my granddad, I mean, he's 94 now. You know, he's still alive. He still lives, as we say, one creek over from us. And his name is Bud, and he's just a great human being. And him and Uncle Fox Hayes are just extremely close friends. I mean, you know, have been dear friends for 60-something years. And really, that's how our two families came together was their friendship. And, I mean, they hit it off from day one and have been inseparable ever since. So, you know, and I try not to get emotional when I say this, but when we found out we were having a boy, I mean, it was pretty clear, you know, what his name was going to be. And he's just, I mean, when you see him, he reminds me so much of his namesake. You know, he's just got, you know, this spirit about him, and just, you can tell he just enjoys life. And that's what I say about my granddad. I mean, he's a man of joy. I mean, he's a man that has never seen evil in anyone. I mean, you know, he does not, you know, hold grudges. I mean, he's someone, I doubt he's ever had an enemy in his life. And, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for that simple, you know, simple heart and simple life that, you know, that he leads. And I think he's just a tremendous example for all of us. So I hope his name sounds a lot like him.
No doubt. And so, all right, go into just a little more detail for me about father and Mr. Fox. How did they meet? Is Mr. Fox actually your uncle, or is that a thing you say?
Yeah, that's just, you know, we say, I mean, not blood related is the way I describe it. You know, but basically, our family has a cattle farm, and, you know, we have a stockyard there in Livingston, and Uncle Fox was actually working for Brian Foods back in the day, and he'd go around to these stockyards, you know, and, I mean, he'd buy the cattle and hogs and stuff like that. And so he was here one week, and the guy that owned the stockyard actually connected Uncle Fox and Bud, and they went bird hunting, and, you know, they just hit it off from there. And so they ended up getting river camps on the Tombigbee River together, you know, right next to each other. My mom and Toxie had their first birthdays jointly together there, you know, and it just, they grew up together. You know, and it's just a, I guess you'd say we're now in the fifth generation now because, you know, Bud and my nephews and, of course, you know, Sarah Francis and Vandy's two girls are all
right,
the same
kids.
Age. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's just, oh, yeah, it's just, it's a lot of fun. And all our great memories have been together. We, their camp is 2 miles up the road from our farm. So, I mean, it's, you know, when they're down
and,
here, I mean, we're up there at the camp.
Is that when you... What you're calling their camp, is that what they call Shamula, or what I've heard of
yeah,
called Shamula?
Yeah, yep,
okay.
That's it.
Okay.
That's it. So, yeah.
And
yeah,
that was initially
just a lot
for...
of fun. Yeah, it's just a lot of fun and special family relationship, you know. And, I mean, the thing that I'm so proud of is that as a company, you know, Mossy Oak, I mean, a lot of consumers, you know, out there, I mean, they feel that warmth and that authenticity. And, I mean, it's real. You know, it is very much family-centered. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, Uncle Fox has been, you know, a huge inspiration, you know, on the entire, you know, company. And, I mean, he is more, you know, as influential today as he was, you know, in the inception of the brand.
Yeah, no doubt. It's, the family aspect, I've heard people say several times about our culture, just American culture, that the demise of the traditional American family has been maybe one of the greatest, detriments to our American culture. And you, the converse of that is true about Mossy Oak. You can totally see the multi-generational family value system and the patriarchy and the shepherding of, you know, of mom and dad for multi generations. It's and you're right. You can't fake that kind of warmth and that kind of connection. You know, it's very obvious.
Yeah, and I think we all recognize, you know, not only with just that the conservation that, you know, we do have a very big spotlight and a very very big, you know, microphone to be able to espouse those values. You know, and I think that, I'm proud of as a company that, you know, we are who we say we are and, you know, at our core and certainly, you know, like you said, I mean, and that's something about rural America in general, you know, a lot of those issues that you see that are plaguing this country have been, maybe not as pronounced in at least the
mm-hmm.
demographic,
rural.
That, you know, still hunt, still fishes, you know, and I mean, you know, you hear all the time, not to go down this rabbit hole, but about, you know, I mean, statistically speaking, I mean, you know, hunting is in decline, but the one thing that is a positive is that female hunters, you know, are certainly on the rise. And typically, you know, speaking, I mean, that's going to be a very good thing for the family dynamic of hunting because, you know, if mom wants to hunt, husband's going to want to hunt, the kids are going to want to hunt. So, you know, that whole family unit taking a part in those traditions, I think, is something that, you know, we need to try to encourage all that we can, you know, and make sure that we're bringing as many new people into the sport and, you know, being inclusive because a lot of the people that are trying to get into the sport of hunting now are people that probably don't look or maybe even vote like you and I do because they're in it for
different
reasons, and we've got to be mindful of that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right about all of that, for sure. So, talk to me about give me your earliest turkey memories. Where did you meet a wild turkey?
Well, you know, we're fortunate. We've got a farm here in you know, Sumter County, Alabama, that, you know, is always, at least for as long as we know, you know, has had huntable populations of turkeys. In fact, there was actually a plantation on our farm like there were many, you know, parts of this country. And, during, I think in the late 1860s, early 1870s, we actually have a letter from the guy that owned the farm then, talking about, you know, hunting wild turkeys and, you know, having them for Thanksgiving dinner and stuff. So that's pretty cool to, you know, take that, you know, 100 plus year back look at our place and know that wild turkeys were here. But, you know, as far as we know, even during the dark ages of, you know, when turkey numbers were almost to the point of extinction,
yep.
because we're kind of on a river drainage, we, to our knowledge, have always had turkeys. I mean, my granddad, you know, they bought this farm in 1940, and, you know, he remembers hunting turkeys continually all throughout his life here. So, which
that's unreal.
Pretty interesting. Yeah, pretty neat. So, the first memories I have of turkey hunting, well, I know that, you know, I accompanied Dad in this river swamp we had in the spring of 1995. I was 9 years old at the time, and, man, you know, river swamp in and of itself is just a place that you can walk into and don't even have to hear a turkey. You feel this mm-hmm. just, energy. I mean, it's just something that just oozes of timelessness. And,
mm-hmm.
I guess I recognized that even then, but man, when that gobble rang out, I mean, it was like spiritual. I mean, it was, but the thing that I was so blessed of is, you know, I had a dad that, and a grandfather that, you know, were so passionate about the sport and did it the right way. And, you know, and of course being around Mossy Oak, you know, I mean, it was not something that I had to look very far to find direction on, you know, is this something I wanted to be passionate about in life? So it grabbed a hold of me very early.
In 1995, was your dad working for Mossy Oak?
No, he was not at the time. They didn't actually start Mossy Oak Properties until 1999. So he was actually, believe in 95, he had his own real estate company, and that's kind of what morphed into Mossy Oak Properties. But, you know, we were around, you know, because of the friendship. I mean, Toxie, of course,
right.
Actually Dad and Toxie owned Shemula at one time together. So, you know, I mean, when they were the early days, what was really, a lot of people don't realize this is, you know, early on in Mossy Oak, I mean, they didn't have a multi-million dollar marketing budget and things like that. A lot of their marketing was, they'd have in, you know, a lot of these outdoor mm-hmm. riders, you know, John Phillips and people like that up at the camp, you know, and they'd take them hunting. And, of course, they ended up having those hunts down at Bent Creek and, you know, would have kind of that
mm-hmm.
who's who of turkey hunting, you know, would come down there and write articles and things. So I got exposed to all that at an early age, which is something that is really, you know, I feel very blessed to, you know, be around the folks that I was around, you know, even if I didn't get to hunt with them, you know, I mean, I looked up to, you know, a lot of these people like Michael Jordan and, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and people like that. I mean, that's who they were in the sport of turkey hunting and still are legends, but I got to be around them at an early age and, you know, just a very, I look back on it and have a lot of, you know, a lot of thankfulness that I was able to experience that.
No doubt. That's it's interesting what you just said about not having a multi-million dollar marketing budget and kind of, and one of the things that you said there about just taking people hunting resonated with one of the things I heard someone say to me. You know, my company's only 10 years old, right? So I'm an infant in the industry, but somebody told me when I first got started that to make your living in this industry, it would cost you your career actually out in the woods hunting. And I
mm-hmm,
remember
mm-hmm.
that being said to me, and I thought to myself, I'm never going to let that happen. Like the moment that being a call maker keeps me from being able to go hunting is the moment that I don't really deserve to be a call maker, because you gotta be an active participant in the sport that you're benefiting from, in my opinion, you know, like, and I remember thinking my entire, as long as I can remember about Mossy Oak, I remember thinking that about Toxie. That
mm-hmm.
best I could tell, I didn't have a personal friendship with him or any of the other, you know, top brass. But everybody that I knew that was a who's who at Mossy Oak from a distance, they all hunted about every day, you know, or as much as they could. But it never.
No, you're exactly right. And I mean, you know, I definitely would disagree with whoever said that, because, I mean, that's the reason why, you know, Mossy Oak, I mean, the thing about Mossy Oak I'm most proud of, you know, and I guess you'd say I'm unique in the fact that, you know, I work here, I'm growing up around the brand, I have this deep appreciation, but I'm also a hunter, you know, conservationist in my core. And, you know, I mean, I'm able to take a step back and look at our company in that light. But the thing that, you know, Mossy Oak, I think, and this is a credit to Foxy and, you know, Bill and Cuz and Uncle Fox and all the others in leadership, is they never put, you know, Mossy Oak on this ivory pedestal. I mean, it was a very accessible brand and a very relational brand. And the fact is that consumers see Mossy Oak as a symbol of connection with those that, you know, love and have a passion for the outdoors. And the resurgence of Bottomland, in my opinion, has been nothing more than an extension of that sentiment, because, you know, Bottomland is not just a camo pattern for people. I mean, there's thousands of camo patterns out there. It's a memory for them. It's the first camo that they wore, you know, when they were out hunting with their dad. And I mean, it's you know, they got hand-me-downs from their older brother and stuff. And the resurgence you see, especially with, you know, people that are in that 18 to 35 year old demographic, that, you know, some of them weren't even born when Toxie first grabbed that fistful of dirt. You know, I think it goes back to that. I mean, when they were, you know, 100%. Their first memories of, yeah, dad bringing home a turkey and wearing Bottomland. So anyways, it's been really interesting to see how a pattern that basically didn't have any marketing dollars behind it for 25 to 30 plus years has the brand loyalty is what it does. And it's just cool to see how that is expanding, you know, and it just shows, I think, how the seeds have been planted in the right way for the long haul for Mossy Oak. And I'm very, you know, very proud of our leadership for doing that.
Yeah, you definitely reap what you sow. And that was a long, convoluted story of mine to say that is one of many things that I've tried to, in a small way, pattern in my own company after what I saw, you know, in Mossy Oak. And to your point, all of those guys deserve to be commended for that, because it's really easy to lose touch and get a big head and think, you know, put the brand on an ivory tower, like you said, and they haven't done that. It's one of my favorite things about them.
Exactly right. But, yeah, Spencer, one thing I want to say is that, you know, the cool thing about the brand is that whether you're, you know, a doctor from Atlanta that has a deer hunting place in Georgia, or a coal miner from West Virginia, or all points in between, it's Mossy Oak's all-inclusive brand. I mean, it means the same thing, the goodness of the outdoors, to white-collar America, silver-collar America, and blue-collar America. And that's something that is pretty unique. Brands, a lot of times, don't have that sort of inclusive nature, and that's something that I, you know, am very proud of.
You said that better than I could have ever said that, and that is spot on. I'm not going to add anything to it. That is very well said. cross demographic and socioeconomic status. I mean, it's very inclusive is the right word.
Absolutely.
So let's change gears for just a second, because a lot of people probably in today's social media world know you as much or more for the Wild Turkey Report as they do for being, you know, an employee of Mossy Oak or an employee of Mossy Oak Properties. Talk to me about Wild Turkey Report. What is it? Kind of go there for me.
Yeah, absolutely. So Wild Turkey Report, you know, time flies by. I want to say we started it in 2011 or 12, but basically we started seeing the shift, you know, from away from print towards digital. And we said, you know, there's a lot of, or there's a lack of information in the digital form, you know, for turkey hunting. And so we basically kind of jumped ahead of the train a little bit and got the website, you know, and did a pretty good job for 3 or 4 years of, you know, posting articles, and then I ran out of ideas. But we tried to structure it where it was evergreen content. I mean, a lot of that stuff you'll go through there and read and, you know, have no clue that it was written 5 or 6 years ago. But basically, you know, doing that, we I guess you'd say, and when I say this, I mean it's myself, my college roommate, his dad, or you know, the three brains, I guess you'd say, behind Wild Turkey Report. But we really became pretty prolific, I guess you'd say, on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And it's been a lot of fun, Spencer. I mean, the relationships that I've personally made with folks, you know, via Wild Turkey Report. I mean, I got, you know, folks all across the country that, you know, I've gotten to be friends with that I've never met them in person. Some of them I've never even talked to on the phone, but I text all the time about turkey hunting. And, yeah, and you know, some of those boys I'm talking about. So it's something that has been a lot of fun. And the thing is, a lot of people had no clue that I did the Turkey Report, and I did that by design because, you know, I didn't want to ever become a, you know, a name or anything like that. I mean, our focus is on the wild turkey, and we don't ever want to take, I mean, if you look on our Instagram account, you're probably never going to see, unless it's, you know, promoting a Facebook Live we're doing on prescribed burning or something, you're just not going to see, you know, my face there. I try to stand back from all that. But I have had a lot of fun with it. But the thing that's been interesting the last 5 years in particular is kind of, you know, being able to take a temperature on what a lot of people think are, you know, may or may not be going on with, you know, turkey populations and things like that. And obviously, I don't intend to go down that rabbit hole unless need be. But it has been interesting to get perspective from a lot of different people across the country on things like that. Of course, the fun thing is, too, is, I mean, you know, I've kind of got, you know, my spring that goes on, but I'm getting tagged in photos all across the country. You know, even when I hang the gun up and, you know, I mean, basically quit hunting for the year, I still got folks that are hunting up in, you know, the Northeast and up in the Midwest that are still going that are tagging me in pictures. So I'm kind of getting to enjoy their spring vicariously a little bit.
That's good. I loved what you just said, and I want to say it one more time because as you're saying it, I pulled it up, but that you mentioned that when you pull up Wild Turkey Report on Instagram, you just don't see very many faces, and you were talking about your face, but the reality is one of the coolest things about it, from a distance is there's not many faces at all. I mean, it's except for turkey faces.
Yeah,
I'm sure that's
absolutely.
Not an accident.
Well, no, it's not, you know, because I'm one that, you know, I love the wild turkey, and I mean, I think that it, maybe the Wild Turkey Report's kind of a shrine or tribute to that magnificent bird, you know, more so than just the hunt itself, you know, and obviously you're going to see a lot of, you know, habitat management stuff on there. That's something I'm extremely passionate about. You know, I don't make any bones about it that, you know, I'm a hunter conservationist and not just a hunter. You know, and I certainly, you know, try to beat that drum, you know, and bang that gong as much as I can, because I think that's something we all owe it to this resource, you know, and our future generations to do. But we're so blessed to have incredible photographers and, you know, videographers that are constantly tagging us and content and being so gracious, you know, for us to pass it on. And really all the credit goes to them. We're just simply, you know, a lot of times providing them a medium to help grow their platforms, you know, and build awareness of what they're doing, in exchange for, you know, helping us connect with you know, people that love turkey hunting.
Yeah. That's been a very fun thing about Instagram just in general is the photography in the outdoor industry over the last 10 years has, I mean, not that the guys pre 10 years ago, let's just say, were not talented, but oh my gosh, the amount of quality photography coming out of the outdoor industry is remarkable. And that's fun to see that on your page for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's every day I get tagged in a photo that takes my breath away, you know, that's just done. I mean, it's like a painting. I mean, I saw one yesterday that I can't remember who it was tagged me, and it literally took me 5 minutes to convince myself that it was not a painting. The lighting and everything is just beautiful. So, yeah.
I need to go look through your tags and see what that was. All right, so change gears on you again here, and one of the things that I've heard about you through the grapevine, and I've probably heard this 5 or 6 different times from various people, but you are definitely, at least by rumor, one of the people that has a more adamant, or at least this is what I've heard, set of rules of engagement than maybe anybody else I know. I is that fair?
Yeah, I guess you'd say that. I you know, we all, and that's the unique thing about what we do, Spence, is that, you know, if someone's a you know, with all due respect, you know, this may show my ignorance, you know, but if there's only so many ways you can ice fish, okay? There's only so many ways you can, you know, dove hunt. Turkey hunting can be very, very diverse in the ways that the approach. And I mean, if you hunt with 10 people in the spring or 20 people in the spring, you're going to have, you know, you just step back and observe, you know, everybody's going to have a sort of method, you know, for by and large. Now, I will say some of the better ones I've ever hunted with had lots of different methods, and that's what made them so successful, and they were very adaptable. But we all have a pattern, so to speak, and a lot of that really comes from, you know, how we, you know, grew up and matured in sport, whether that be on our own or, you know, the way we were molded. I mean, my dad and I, you know, I mean, I hunt like him, I guess. There's just not much that I do differently because I hunt with him probably, you know, 30 days out of the year, 25 or 30 days out of the year. You know, we yelp differently a little bit, but, you know, a lot of our hunting style is exactly the same. And so, you know, I learned, you know, my style from hunting with him, and a lot of the folks I hunt with hunt the exact same way. And, you know, there's certain things that, you know, technologies that we have now that, you know, for whatever reason, I mean, we didn't hunt that way, you know, growing up because they were either, you know, not allowed in the state or either the technology wasn't there yet. So, you know, I guess you'd say I've sort of, you know, crafted my approach, but, you know, anyone that knows me and knows me well knows that the main rush for me in the sport is calling. I mean, that is like, you know, I love to hear them gobble. I mean, I absolutely love to hear them gobble. If I can go and just hear a turkey gobble one time in the morning, you know, praise the Lord, that was the best day I've ever had. You know, but that communication and conversation with a gobbler to me is something that is just, I can't really put in the words. I'm going to try to put in the words what that means to me. But, you know, one of my quirks, I guess you'd say, Spencer, is that, and my friends will know that, I'm kind of an impersonator. I have a lot of different accents I use, and they all think it's funny. And some of them think it's a lot funnier after 2 or 3 bourbon drinks. you know, I've got kind of a, I guess you'd say a musical ear, you know, and I've always been blessed with, you know, I picked up calling pretty easy. I mean, I started first turkey calling when I was 9. I was entering contests, you know, and at 12 and 13, I was on the David Letterman show. So, I mean, I progressed, I guess, for all intents and purposes, really quickly, and it had, you know, something to do with obviously having great, you know, a great teacher, my dad being a great caller, you know, having a mom that was understanding and didn't get annoyed too quickly. And then just I guess I had a musical ear and a lot of passion, but calling for me is just, I mean, that is like the rush to me, having that conversation with that gobbler. But my whole game is like, when I step out of the truck in the morning, I become a turkey. I mean, that's to me like the ultimate goal. To say in the acting world, I'm going into character, okay? I mean, I'm taking on the role of hen. And my job basically is to essentially, you know, connect with that gobbler, to communicate with them, and then close the deal, make the sale, and you know, getting them within, you know, 40 yards for a clean ethical shot. And that's why I hunt pretty much with just a gun, a mouth call, and a slate, and of course a Dixon vest, because you got to have a Dixon vest. But I mean, you know, you just bought one, you know, I mean, and congrats on that. I mean, what a heirloom you got. So, but I guess you could say I'm very simplistic in the way I hunt. And it's just, to me, the one of the most challenging and coolest parts of the hunt, and a lot of it depends on where you're at, but a lot of times I'm hunting, you know, turkeys in pine plantations, you know, I mean, I'm not hunting turkeys in big fields and things like that. So there's a certain point in every hunt where essentially that turkey, you know, has made an approach to a certain point where his decision making shifts from being, you know, hearing in nature to becoming visual. And that last, you know, whether it's 70 yards, 100 yards, 40 yards, whatever it may be, when that shifts right there, what you've got to do at that point, you know, is either, you know, rely on, you know, obviously your soft stuff to try to trick them into where you are, or have painted a picture, you know, to where he's going to keep coming, you know, and throw caution in the wind, or think the hen's farther back, or whatever it may be. I absolutely love that chess match. And for me personally, and I'm not going to, you know, certain tools and tactics would negate that side of the game for me, in my opinion, and would diametrically change that sort of, you know, chess match at the end of the hunt, just because that visual sort of thing would take over. And, you know, and I know it's not foolproof, but that would be essentially becoming the tool that, you know, I've employed, that he relied on, and not the calling and communication and trying to close out the deal. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly am simplistic in that way.
All right,
you know,
wait, I got to interrupt you. I got to interrupt you. You're being far too kind and political and polite right now. you got to be a little, take your gloves off just a little bit. So
well,
what you're saying is you don't hunt over decoys.
I do not. Now, let me just, I'm going to take a step back, Spencer, and understand that, you know, we actually, I mean, Alabama, and I don't know the exact year, I mean, it was probably, 2006, 7 or 8 before they were legalized in the state of Alabama. So, I mean, I learned how to hunt my entire way of thinking about setup and calling and all those things was based around not having decoys to hunt over. And so that's one reason why I despise field turkeys, and a lot of times walk the other way when I hear a turkey gobbler in the field. So, you know, I mean, it's just, and that's the cool thing, is that everyone has, you know, choices to make in how they become as a turkey hunter. I mean, if they, you know, love to call, and, you know, I mean, that's what they base it around, they're probably going to be, you know, they may be more on my end of the spectrum if, you know, their basic goal is to try to, you know, throw a turkey in the back of the truck, you know, regardless of what it takes, as long as it's legal and ethical and things like that, they may employ more tools. I've just got a certain way that I enjoy playing the game. Doesn't mean that anyone's, you know, way of playing it is right or wrong, so long as it's, you know, legal and, you know, and ethical. You know, anyways, we all have a choice, and that's the unique thing about what we have, you know, is that we do have those choices to make.
I appreciate the way that you're saying that, and I know I'm going to say this for you because I know this is where this is coming from, but you're being kind and you're being polite and you're being political because I mean for one reason because that's just the right way to say it, but the main reason that the main reason I think that you're handling it this way is that I think genuinely in your heart you're really okay with somebody else hunting over a decoy. Is that fair?
I am. You know, and obviously, I mean, let's just take a step back, you know, in some things. I mean, we are more effective as hunters nowadays. I mean, there's between the camo we wear, the shells we shoot, the decoys we have, you know, in our thing. And, you know, as long as someone in their heart feels like what they're doing is fair chase, you know, I mean, and everyone has to decide that for themselves. I mean, there may be somebody that listens to the way I yelp and say, you know, hey, I don't know, no one's going to ever say I'm too good or anything, but, you know, I mean, everyone in their heart has to decide what fair chase is. And certainly if there's a tool that they employ that they're like, you know, I didn't feel I gave the turkey the fair shot on this. And look, obviously, let's just, you know, kind of tackle the elephant in the room. You know, TV and shows kind of, you know, because I'm not using those things like fans and strutting decoys and even Jake decoys and things, my opinion's molded off of what I see off the internet. And I, in my mind, think that, you know, you hold up a fan to a turkey out in Nebraska, he leaves 10 or 15 hens and comes running up there. and that's not always the case. And I know that. You know, I'm,
right.
I'm, I guess, smart or dumb enough to cut through the mustard on that one. But, you know, I think that, you know, the realization is that we are more effective and more people can be more effective now. And that's great because, you know, when people are not successful in something, they eventually lose interest. And when we lose interest in hunting, we potentially lose foot soldiers for conservation.
And no doubt.
That's something right now, we need people to be on the front lines of conservation more than ever. I mean, you know, whether someone, you know, is seeing this themselves, not seeing them themselves, I mean, statistically and in data speaking, this is not just fear mongering. I mean, by and large, in a lot of places, I mean, we are having turkey population concerns. And really, a lot of this boils down to the fact that, you know, we're just not raising as many turkeys as we used to. Now, this is a very complex issue because it's not like there's one silver bullet, but every hunter can do something to ensure that this problem is not exacerbated 10, 15, 20 years down the road, and your kids and my kids, you know, don't ask us when they're in their teens, you know, what turkeys used to sound like when they gobble. I don't think we're headed there, but we need to be very mindful of the fact that as hunters, you know, we're responsible for more than just pulling the trigger. I mean, we're responsible for being the front lines of conservation. And yeah. I know that there's a lot of people that all they do is hunt public land. They listen to this and say, well, okay, Dave, well, what do you mean by that? Well, you know, this year's a prime example. There's been a ton of turkeys killed because of COVID-19. And, you know, there's been a lot of people that have been recruited into the sport and hooked on the sport because of the success they've had. That's great. Will there be, you know, impacts on turkey numbers, you know, moving forward from this? Time will tell. But I guess my caution is that, you know, maybe it is a time to show a little bit of restraint. You know, if you've got a tag or two left and you feel like, you know, you've done all you needed to do, you know, maybe you leave that tag in your pocket and tag along with a buddy, you know, on another piece of public or something, you know, and not worry about if someone goes in there and kills that turkey. I mean, those little mindset shifts can go a long ways in ensuring that the resource does not get stressed to the max because I personally feel, Spencer, that gobbler harvest, kind of like my dad says, it's not a problem until it's a problem and then it's a big problem. If you've got basically, if you're recruiting turkeys at a, you know, at a healthy level, I mean, gobbler harvest is not going to be a huge issue in most cases unless there's just a influx or a, I guess you'd say a mass fluctuation in gobbler harvest. You know, is this one of those years that maybe, you know, that may be the case? I don't know. We'll find out. But the core of it is that we're not raising as many turkeys. And that's something that is a habitat issue. There's just a lot of landowners across the South, private, public, corporate, that could be actively managing for their turkeys and are not. And we all kind of, you know, we're all
feed
kind
off of that.
Exactly. And I mean, really fixing this and making sure, I guess you'd say making sure that the problem does not become an exponential one is really going to take, I guess you'd say a collaboration between state agencies and setting frameworks that ensure, you know, that, turkeys have adequate opportunities to breed, that we're not over harvesting, you know, males, that, you know, that there's plenty of carryover gobblers from years to year to cover the years that maybe you do have an off, you know, Jake crop or something. It's going to be, you know, advocacy from the NWTF and, you know, local organizations and setting, I guess you'd say guidelines on what we as landowners should be doing and best practices. And of course, you know, biologists and chipping in with that. And there's some great ones right now, you know, that are doing a great job on social media of kind of bringing light to some of the issues and some of the things that we need to be doing to, you know, do that. But there's also, this is something that I've always felt, is that conservation is not possible without boots on the ground. And boots on the ground, in this case, when it comes to habitat, is landowners. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. You know, if we are to change any declines in poult recruitment, which is where it all starts, it's got to be from improvement of the lands in which they live. And that's where it always is going to fall, in my opinion. And so, you know, if you own land, you're listening to this, you know, explore what you can do from a habitat standpoint to raise more turkeys first and foremost, and then hold them on your property. Make sure they've got everything that they need. You know, and certainly, I mean, that's been my biggest mindset the last 4 or 5 years. You know, I mean, we honestly, Spencer, I mean, when I first started hearing about regional declines in, say, 2013 or 14, I thought it was just people trying to raise money. And then I experienced it in 2015 when basically our quality of hunting came to a screeching halt. Never once questioned numbers, never once questioned, you know, anything other than, you know, I mean, am I going to hear 5 turkeys this morning or 7? And then you go to where half the 2015 season I didn't hear a turkey. Single turkey gobble. The rest of the days, I think the most I heard was, you know, 2 or 3. So it was a wake up call. And honestly, I mean, my mindset just was like, okay, you know, all this, you know, stuff that I've been hearing about being a gamekeeper and all this, I mean, I've got a chance to put, you know, put my money where my mouth is. And so, I mean, we definitely, you know, try to do everything we can. You know, and certainly it's a battle every day. You know, I mean, you trap predators, and then, you know, you hope you have a good hatch, you burn and hope you provide the right habitat for them. And then really it's kind of up to Mother Nature and God's hands, you know, but you're trying to meet them halfway and give turkeys the best chance they can to survive.
I didn't mean to rabbit hole you too far on the decoy conversation. What I was really hoping that people would hear is that it's possible to have a set of standards that you hold yourself to that don't require you fighting social media morality wars all the time. Because I don't ever see, for having a standard like that for yourself, I don't ever see you engaging in shame and you know, judgment towards people who are hunting over decoys, or I hunt over decoys a lot. It's really difficult to film without decoys, and nearly impossible. And I've never once, I mean, not only have I not known that about you, I've never once experienced feeling like, you know, I was less of a hunter, or that you made me, you know, look down your nose at me or anything like that. And I think there's a positive example there that I hope people listening will take note of and emulate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it certainly, I mean, you know, I always encourage people, I mean, especially with, you know, fans and strutting decoys, safety's got to come first in anything you do with that. I mean, even when you're just calling, I mean, you got to be smart. I mean, you know, no one wants to have an accident. So you got to be, you know, kind of a defensive hunter like you are a defensive driver. But, you know, really it's just, you know, everyone's got to make those decisions for themselves and, you know, decide what, you know, what really motivates them. And, you know, if they do have questions about, hey, is this crossing the line of fair chase? That's their thing to decide, not, you know, mine to get on social media and, you know, obviously, you know, like I said, I mean, videos and things like that have certainly molded the way we think about certain tactics and certain techniques. And, you know, they do cause in the question. And I think it's a fair one, just giving off the example of, you know, are these things fair because of the response you see, but the people that are employing them, you know, a lot of them will tell you that, yeah, it's not 100% foolproof. I mean, a lot of times you hold up that fan and the turkey head's out of the way, but everyone's got to figure out that moral, you know, dilemma on their own. It's not going to be somebody banging their head over a, you know, keyboard on social media to get them to figure that out on their own.
Yeah. I hunt over a Jake and a hen a lot for a couple reasons. One is that our swamp is in the Delta, and so we have big fields, you know, with that are on the edges of swamps. We don't have vast tracts of hardwoods and plantation pines like you guys do, because our ground is so fertile that if you're growing pine trees, it means you're not growing cotton. And so we have, you know, we grew up hunting different. We grew up hunting with decoys, you know, for probably because we were hunting primarily birds that lived on fields on the edges of swamps. But to that point, I would be the first to admit that a Jake decoy is definitely an advantage over not having a Jake decoy. I mean, there's no question in my mind that the reason that I use a Jake decoy is because it increases the odds that I can get that turkey to stand in front of Dylan Farrell longer and stiller and better looking. I mean, and if you told me tomorrow that male turkey decoys across the country were banned, I mean, there'd be a little part of me, it would be bittersweet, but in the name of conservation, I have to admit it would definitely mean that there were less turkeys get killed. There's no doubt in my mind.
And that's something that obviously, I mean, you know, like I said earlier, I mean, as a whole, and it's not just decoys. I mean, it's everything. I mean, we're more effective, you know, as hunters now. And I think that certainly the states are going to have some real tough decisions to make the next few years on how they address that. Because even if there's not declines in turkey, you know, reproduction and things are staying stable, you know, if more, I guess what you say, if more turkeys are being killed, at some point that sort of crossover point is going to be reached in which populations, at least on the male side of things, do start to back up. And so, you know, I really feel like here in Alabama, you know, I mean, we have the most liberal bag limit in the entire country at 5. I mean, I stopped at 3 this year. I've just, you know, I didn't feel like we had the numbers to justify killing 2 more. And I just said, you know what? I've had a great season. I've tagged along with my dad and buddies and things like that. So, but I could see our state probably, you know, making some changes. And I think there'll be some other states that will take, you know, some looks at different things, whether that be, you know, the early season, you know, framework where it's like kind of like what South Carolina did, you know, where I think it's the first 10 days or whatever, you can only harvest one. Because to be honest with you, Spencer, I mean, when Dr. Chamberlain and them first came out with the notion of, you know, that we're killing gobblers too early, I mean, honestly, I thought, that's, but it kind of does make sense the more I think about it, you know, and it will be interesting to see, you know, because our season started the 21st here this year, and I mean, we kind of, you know, seem to have a little bit earlier breeding cycle, and it'll be interesting to see if it has any sort of, you know, reproductive benefit. But my thing is, and I hope all, you know, hunters can identify with this. If we put the bird first in all of our decisions instead of just our own, you know, our own, I hate to say selfish desires, that's kind of a carnal way of looking at it, but just if we put the bird first and the resource first in all of our decisions, the hunting quality is going to take care of itself. And that's just something that I really feel that we, you know, I've seen it through the Wild Turkey Report. I have seen a lot of people that are my age and younger really jumping on the bandwagon of conservation. And that's something that's pretty neat to see. We live in kind of, as you see on social media, a lot of social media is just me. You know, it's a self-serving sort of platform, but seeing a lot of service towards conservation. And that's really got me encouraged for the future.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. All right, last question, and I've got to go build a. Speaking of conservation, I've got two little girls looking at me. That they're not little anymore, but they want a butterfly garden built this afternoon, and so I'm actually about to pick up some lumber and build an above a raised bed for some butterflies. But last question, you know, hopefully it's a 50 or more years from now, but when they stand over your casket, how do you want to be remembered?
Oh, man. You know, obviously, I mean, from just the personal side of things, I mean, you know, Christian man, love the Lord, you know, love his family, you know, man of integrity, man of honor, unwavering values, but you know, I think when it comes to conservation, I mean, you know, I really just, I've been called by some people here an old man in this regard, because being 34 and kind of thinking about, you know, 100 plus years down the road, but in anyone that's a landowner, that's I guess you'd say legacy landowner can attest to this, but you know, I feel a great debt towards, you know, I mean, on my grandmother's side of things. I mean, I'm seventh generation landowner on one piece of property, and you know, fourth generation on this one. Of course, Bud will be fifth on our home place. And I mean, this farm is a gift from God that's been given to us. And I mean, we have a responsibility to be good stewards of it, and never to put, you know, dollars over what is right for, you know, this property and wildlife to call it home. So, and I hope that. You know, through platforms like this and Wild Turkey Report and different things, that, you know, maybe I can inspire some people to, certainly, we just kind of, and I don't know if this is in closing or whatever. I mean, there's just, we need more foot soldiers that are on the front lines of conservation. I mean, you know, this is not going to be something solely that, you know, Washington's going to help us with, your state agency is going to help you with, or the NDMTF is going to help us with. If you own land and if you're a hunter, you're where the rubber meets the road. And everyone, I would hope everyone's goal at the end of their days was to know that the sport that they loved, they were an asset for it and were not a detriment, and don't have any asterisks besides their name when people talk about them being a turkey hunter. And that's something that, you know, I take to heart and have always tried to, you know, uphold a standard and not have anyone ever be able to speak a cross word about me and my respect for the wild turkey and all of our wildlife.
That's very well said. Very well said. I've got a million more questions that I want to ask you, but I've got a butterfly guard that needs to be built, and I'm sure you've got something important this afternoon that you need to do. I have thoroughly enjoyed visiting with you, David.
Well, hey, thank you so much, Spencer. And I mean, it's been great. It's been a joy, you know, getting to know you the last few years. And like I said, you're a part of the Mossy Oak family, and we're proud to know you, and thank you for what you do, and you know what you mean for hunting and conservation. You're definitely one of the good guys.
Well, I appreciate that. It's just like you said. You know, that's not, you got to wake up every day and make sure that that's still the case. It's hard to earn and easy to lose. So we're all in it together, So, well, thank you very much for joining us, David, and thank you guys for listening. And I echo everything that David said. If you've got a little piece of dirt, it's on you to make sure that that's a good, safe home for a wild turkey and for a white-tailed deer and maybe even a mallard duck. So thank you for listening, and I hope that you'll catch us again next time on another episode of the Rolling Thunder Podcast. Thank you.